Good evening, everybody. Now, I must admit, I did say the shiur that I'm going to say this evening. I said some years ago, someplace in Yerushalayim. I don't think it was here. I believe it was in Ramot. But in addition to the fact that I already said the shiur once, I have added a great deal to the original shiur, and I believe that there is a message that is extremely timely for those of us who have the great schus to be living in Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh. There is a fascinating dialogue that the Gemara records in Masechta Megillah, Daf Yud Bet Amid Aleph. I want to read the dialogue to you, and of course there are going to be questions. The dialogue goes this way. Shalu Talmidav et Rav Shimon ben Yochai, the students of the great Rebbe, Rav Shimon ben Yochai, asked their Rebbe, Mipnei ma nitchayvu son'ehem shel Yisrael sheba'oto hador kloya. Why were the Jews, and the Gemara uses a euphemism, the euphemism is son'ehem shel Yisrael, the enemies of Israel, what they really mean is Israel. Why was the entire people of Israel under threat of destruction in the days of Mordechai and Esther? What did they do that was so wrong? Incidentally, just a parenthetic comment. Rav Shimon ben Yochai and his students must have been 500-600 years after the Purim story. Very interesting that they were not able to come to grips with the near total annihilation of the Jewish people until hundreds of years later. Back to the dialogue. The students asked their Rebbe, what did Jews do? Why were they under the threat of total destruction? Amar lahem, so the Rebbe said to them, Imru atem, you tell me. You've obviously given it thought. Tell me what you think. Amru lo, the students said to their great Rebbe, Mipnei shenehenu meisudato shel oto harosho, because Jews enjoyed the party of Achashverosh. Achashverosh made a party and Jews came. Amar lahem, so the Rebbe turns to his students and says, well, that's not fair. Im kein, if so, Shebishushan Yaharogu, those Jews who lived in Shushan and went to the party, they're the ones who should be killed. Shebichol ha'olam kulo, Jews throughout the entire world, what are they guilty? Amru lo, so they said to him, okay, Rebbe, emorata, you tell us. Amar lahem, so he said to them, b'pnei shehishtachavu latzelem, b'mei Nebuchadnezzar, because they bowed down to the statue that was erected by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel, an event that took place approximately 45 years before the Purim story. Strange dialogue. What's strange about the dialogue is, first of all, how indeed did the students for a moment assume that the reason why there was a threat of total destruction was because some Jews in Shushan had gone to a party that Achashverosh made, and for that Jews throughout the world should be held liable and guilty to the point that there should be a decree to destroy them all? Reb Shimon ben Yochai's question to his students, it's a very, very good question. It didn't occur to them. And then again, even what Rav Shimon ben Yochai says, because Jews bowed down to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar, an event that took place 45 years earlier, what relationship is there between that event and what takes place in the days of Mordechai and Esther? And I have another problem with Rav Shimon ben Yochai. Shimon Yochai says, because Jews bowed down to the statue. What was that statue? Was it idolatry? Tosfos In the Sechta Pesachim says, on the Gemara, Gemara says the following, Odzu Dorash Todos Ish Romi, Todos, the man of Rome, said the following, Maro Chananya Mishol V'Azariah, why did Chananya Mishol and Azariah see fit to throw themselves into the furnace? Nebuchadnezzar, it's all described in Tanakh. Nebuchadnezzar had erected a mighty statue in the Valley of Dura, and he called upon all people to bow down before that statue. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refused. So the Gemara asks, why did they refuse? Why did? And the punishment was, anybody who's not going to bow down is going to be thrown into a furnace. The end of the story, of course, is that they were thrown into the furnace, they refused to bow down, thrown into the furnace, and they emerged unscathed, unsinged. But the Gemara asks, why did they give their lives? Why were they ready to give their lives? So the Gemara says, they made a kal v'chomer from the tzfardim, the frogs. The frogs in Egypt, the second plague. So the Pasuk says that frogs went in to the houses, the bedrooms, the kitchens, the machsanim. And in the kitchens, they went into the, even into the ovens and the stoves. If tzfardim can go l'kadei shem shamayim, to sanctify God's name, and they don't have a mitzvah of kiddush Hashem, if they can do it, we certainly can do it. Long comes Taisus, and Taisus says the following. Tselem ze she'osa Nebuchadnezzar, this statue that Nebuchadnezzar made, lav avodah zarahu, it wasn't idolatry. Elo andarta, it was a monument, a statue, she'osa l'chvod atzmo, that he made for his own honor and glory. Listen, number one, we can't assume that all Jews simply bowed and prostrated themselves before an idol. What are you talking about? Can't be. Furthermore, if we're talking about a real idol, real paganism, why does the Gemara ask, why did Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah give their lives? Of course, Jews have given their lives out of all of history rather than bow down to an idol. So the Rabbeinu Tam says that this was not an idol, it wasn't pagan or heathen practice of any sort. It was something that Nebuchadnezzar has done for his own honor and glory. And he even quotes a pasuk in Sefer Ezra, where the pasuk says, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah said, Le'elohoch, Les anachna polchen, we will not serve your God. Ulitzelem didahava, and to the statue of gold, lo nisgod, we will not bow. Obviously, the pasuk is telling us that there are two things: there was his idol, and there was his statue. This was an ego trip for Nebuchadnezzar. It may very well have been a form of pledging allegiance to King Nebuchadnezzar. So if it wasn't idolatry, it was no more than pledging allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar. So why does Rav Shimon ben Yochai say, because Jews bowed down to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar, therefore there was a threat of total destruction on all men, women, and children? So I don't understand Rav Shimon ben Yochai either. For that matter, I don't even understand the sin of Nehenu misudato shaloto arosha, that they enjoyed the party of that rosha. The Gemara says in Megillah v'hashtiyak hadat, their drinking was according to law. My kadat, what does it mean according to law? Said Rabbi Yochanan, in the name of Rabbi Meir, kidas shel Torah, it was according to the law of Torah. The Gemara says, with regard to the fact that just like according to Torah, eating should be more than drinking, here also eating was more than drinking. It wasn't a party that was overwhelmingly drinking. Ein ones, it says in the Megillah, nobody was coerced. Gemara explains, la'asot kiritzon ish v'ish, nobody was coerced. Everything was done according to the will of ish for ish, man and man. And the Gemara says, One ish refers to Mordechai, and the other refers to Haman. Ish Yehudi Hayav Shushan Abira, there was a Jew in Shushan Abira, that was Mordechai. Haman ish tsar va'oyev hazeh, this enemy, this oppressor. The fact is, according to the Gemara, the dinner was under hashgacha. I'm sure that if you wanted OU, badats, bells, glatt, vegetarian, it was kiritzon ish v'ish. So what was so terrible? I don't understand the students of Reb Shimon ben Yochai, and I don't understand Reb Shimon ben Yochai. The students of Reb Shimon ben Yochai say because they enjoyed the Suda. What was the problem with enjoying the Suda? Reb Shimon ben Yochai says because 45 years earlier, Jews had bowed down to a statue, so they bowed down to a statue. Worse, you can say it's not nice. Not nice. Jews don't bow down to statues, but it was no more than pledging allegiance to Nebuchadnezzar. I believe that in order to understand the dialogue between Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai and his students, it becomes necessary for me to paint a picture. We are now historically in the days of Purim. We are at the end of the 70 years of the Babylonian exile. What I want to know is, what did Jews look like 69 years earlier when they went off into exile? And what do they look like now toward the end of Golus Babel? Where am I going to get a picture? Where will I be able to find a poignant, powerful, moving description of what Jews looked like at the beginning of the exile and what they looked like at the end? There is a picture extant, a powerful verbal portrayal, the broad, sharp brushstrokes of David HaMelech in Tehillim. Al Naharot Bavel, by the rivers of Babylon, Shom Yoshavnu, there we sat, Gam Bachinu, and we cried, B'zachreinu es Tzion, when we remembered Tzion. Al Aravim B'tocha, on the willows, Tolinu Kinoroteinu, we hung our harps, Kishom She'elunu Shoveinu, because there our captors asked us, Divrei Shir, they wanted us to sing, Jew, Yude, Zingin, sing for me, dance, Jew. V'tolaleinu, and our tormentors called upon us, Simcha, be happy. We're talking about Jews who are in chains, being taken out into exile. Shiru lanu mishir Tzion, the Babylonians said, sing to us the songs of Zion. What was the response of Klal Yisrael? Eich noshir et shir Hashem al admat nechar. How can we sing? How can we sing the songs of God when we are on foreign soil, strange, alien? We're not at home, we're in exile. No joy, no singing. Impossible for us. And it was then that Jews took the oath that rings across the centuries, Imesh Bachech, Yerushalayim Tishkach Yemini, if I forget you, Yerushalayim, let my right hand forget its cunning. Tidbak Lishoni Lechiki Yimloes Kereki, let my tongue stick to the palate of my mouth, if I don't remember you. Imlo A'ale et Yerushalayim, Al Rosh Simchati, if I will not raise Yerushalayim above the moment of my greatest joy. Do you know what we have over here in this chapter in Tehillim? We have a picture of a people unwilling to make peace with the exile. They see the rivers of Babylon as strange, foreign, alien soil. They are tormented. No joy, no happiness. Song? Of course not. Let's flash ahead 70 years later, or 69 to be more precise. 69 years later, Nehenumi Sudato Shaloto Arosha. Jews enjoyed the party of Ahasuerus. I would even suspect that there must have been Jews in Shushan Habira who paid a lot of money to get an invitation. This was a party to end all parties. And Nehenu, they enjoyed the party of that Russia. Obviously something has taken place during the course of 69 years. One picture is the picture of Al-Naharos Babel by the rivers of Babylon, and the other is a picture of Jews sitting around at the party of Ahasuerus. The Rambam, at the beginning of Hilchot Tefillah, the laws of prayer, he describes what happened, Kivin Shegalu Yisrael, Jews went into exile in the days of Nebuchadnezzar. Nit'arvu b'parasu madai, they began to assimilate within the society of Persia and Medes, the Shar Homos and the other nations, and children were born to them who weren't able to speak avort Yiddish, certainly not afilu avort Ivrit lo yadu ledaber b'Ivrit. Raman is explaining that therefore the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, when they returned to Eretz Yisrael, the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, the men of the Great Assembly, composed a Shmona Esrei so that every Jew should be able to pray in a proper sentence in Hebrew. So therefore, the students say, take a look. A dramatic change has taken place. It's not the same Jewish people. It's not Al-Naharos Babel anymore. This is a different people. And if they're enjoying the Suda of Ahasuerus, they're enjoying his party, that means something has happened to Jews worldwide. What they see is Jews who have rejected the past. They're forgetting. In fact, what's most tragic about that party is, do you know what Ahasuerus was celebrating? The Gemara explains he was celebrating the fact that according to his calculation, the 70 years of the Babylonian exile that Yirmiyahu had prophesied. Yirmiyahu had said that at the end of 70 years, Jews are going to go back, they're going to build a Beis HaMikdash, the second Jewish commonwealth is going to rise. And according to his calculation, the 70 years had come to an end and Jews had not returned to Eretz Israel. You know what he's celebrating? He's celebrating the fact that Jews are going to remain subservient in exile forever. And of all the strange things, Jews are present at a party that is really celebrating their own death knell. How insensitive could they be? Rav Shimon ben Yochai turns to his students and he says, yeah, Talmidim, students, meine, you're looking at the end result. But what we have to know for all time is, at what moment did Jews commit the fatal flaw? At what moment did they make the mistake? At what moment could we have predicted that years later they would have lost their longing, their yearning, and their connection for Eretz Yisrael? What was the first mistake? When did they make that fatal mistake? When did the transition begin from an Al-Naharos Babel Jew to a Jew who's enjoying the party of Ahasuerus? What was the crucial moment? Because we have to seek out and we have to identify the cause. And Reb Shimi ben Yochai says, do you know what had happened? It all started 45 years earlier when Jews bowed down to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar. Of course the statue was not idolatry. It was a pledge of allegiance. I can imagine that in the Jewish community of Babel, Persia, there must have been a raging debate. The Persian Jewish Congress most probably came out with a position paper saying that since the government, Dina de Malchuta, Dina, the law of the land is the law, and since King Nebuchadnezzar, may God protect him and care for him, Gemara always refers to him as Nebuchadnezzar, HaRosha, the evil one. Nebuchadnezzar called upon all Jews to pledge allegiance and bow down to him, to the statue of. Well, listen, we're always good citizens, and we have to be good citizens here. And I'm sure that they must have come out with a position paper. Not only that, they must probably ask the halachic authority, and the halachic authority told them, take a look at the Tesis. Tesis himself, the Pesachim, tells you that. Certainly the conference of presidents of major Persian Jewish organizations came into special session, and there's no doubt about it, this was taken very seriously, and therefore there were plenary sessions and nisht plenary sessions, and there were think tanks and all sorts of other things, and finally the Jewish organizations decided that in view of first of all our halachic ruling that this is not idolatry, Dina de Malchuta, Dina, the law of the land is the law, and we're good people, we've always been good people. And most probably they could even quote Yirmiyahu himself, Dir Shuet Shlom Ha'ir, seek the peace of the city that you are going to be exiled to. And therefore they decided that we're going to bow down to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar. And I mean, this was a decision that was taken by the mainstream organizations whose concern was the well-being of the Jewish people. But there were three right-wing extremists. With three fellows called Hanania, Mishael, Azariah, who said, over our dead bodies, we're not going to bow down. I'm certain that there must have been all sorts of meetings that took place between the various Jewish organizations and their representatives with Hanania, Mishael, Azariah. Listen, you have to be moderate, you have to be liberal, you have to be open-minded. You have to be able to look at the situation in terms of the well-being of the Jewish people. No good will come of this. You're going to go into the... You're not going to bow down. You're going to be thrown into the Kivshan Ha'esh and into the furnace, and it's all going to be over. And they most probably told Hanania, Mishael, and Azariah, listen, you have to face facts. The reality is that we are living here. We have a Psak Halacha. The fate of the Jewish people hangs in the balance. It's a time for moderation. It's a time for flexibility. It's a time for compromise. Intransigence will be fatal. So there they were, these three, Hanania, Mishael, Azariah, completely alienated from the rest of the Jewish people, the extremists, uncompromising, unwilling to yield. They happened to believe in some kind of an idea called HaTorah HaShlema, the complete Torah. And therefore, they're not going to bow down. The moderates and the liberals carried the day. The voice of calm and reason prevailed. What they didn't realize, Rav Shimon ben Yochai says, what they didn't realize was that they were setting the Jewish people on a completely different course. They had made the first compromise. They had, for all intents and purposes, made a statement, Babel is our home and our native land. We speak Babylonian. We move in the halls of government of the Babylonian Empire. Our people are pillars of society. What they didn't realize was that they had made the crucial, fatal compromise that was going to show its true colors 45 years later. If you would have told them then that this is what it's going to lead to, they would have told you, you're a fool. Can't be. the leaders of the Jewish community most probably received accolades, they received thanks, most probably they were invited by Nebuchadnezzar to the square room or the rectangular room for having averted the crisis that could have crushed Klal Yisrael. They saw themselves as the saviors of Israel. Jewish survival was now intact. What I'm saying is that there's no machloket really between Reb Shimon ben Yochai and his students. Reb Shimon ben Yochai is pointing out the root cause, the beginning, the moment at which anybody who had a clear thinking mind should have been able to predict that 45 or 50 or 60 years later, Jews would be assimilating into Persian and Babylonian society. Sure, technically, no sin, but in fact, it sealed the fate of a people. It delayed Geula for thousands of years. Jews who are nene misudoso sheloso hagasha, Jews who enjoy the party of that gosha, are not in a terrible hurry to go on aliyah. They're shluckish. Shluckish is the one who made the statement, Samnina lechu bavloi, I hate you Babylonians. Shelo alitem bimei Ezra, you didn't go up on aliyah in the days of Ezra. By the way, while Jews were sitting at the party of Ahasuerus, the first Olim who had returned, the first group of Shivat Zion, was struggling to build this city surrounded by enemies. And Jews in Shushan hutzked away at Ahasuerus' party. The same time, here Jews are suffering and their Jews are feasting. First exiles had already returned. Not only the first exiles had already returned, more than that, the construction of the Beit HaMikdash had begun, and it was stopped. Jews were told that they can't build in Yerushalayim. What does the Gemara say in Masechta Megillah? Esther comes in to the queen. She really is placing her life on the line. And she says to the king, the king sees her, and he says to her, Esther Amalka, Ma she'elatechu, ma bakashatechu, what do you want? Ad chatzi hamalchut, until half of the kingdom, v'teyas, and I'll do it for you. Says the Gemara, you know what he meant? Ad dovar shechotzeitz malchuti, I'll give you everything except something that will divide my kingdom. I will not permit the building of the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim. No construction in Yerushalayim, he said. Anything you can ask of me. Not that. The Gemara says it. The Gemara says it. And here, he had made his calculations. Ahasuerus had made the calculations, and he said, Kivin dechazu, when he saw the Malu Shivin, 70 years had ended, according to his calculation, Velo Ifruk, and they have not been redeemed, they're not going to be redeemed anymore. And that's why he makes a party, and Jews are enjoying the party with him. Ezra describes the fact that they had stopped construction in Yerushalayim. Ezra says the following, Beidayin ven betilis avidas beit Eloho. They stopped the construction of the house of God and the Chomah of Yerushalayim and the Har. No building on the Har and no building of the Chomah. And it remained. Pasuk in Ezra says, it remained this way until the second year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, is going to permit construction again. So we're talking about a Klal Yisrael no longer on the Hadron's Babel, it's no longer the people who are at the rivers of Babylon. They've changed dramatically. They no longer see Babel as strange, foreign, and alien territory. They see Babel now as their home. How does one lift Klal Yisrael out of the depths to which it has fallen? How are they to be saved? I want to tell you something that I heard. And yes, I'm in a position that I can talk about something that I heard 35 years ago. And when I heard this statement 35 years ago, a shiver went down my spine. Heard a statement that sent a shiver down my spine. It was at a dinner in Toronto for a yeshiva. And the guest speaker was Rav Shneur Kotler, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, the Rosh Shiva then of the Lakewood Yeshiva. And he said something in the name of his father, Rav Aaron Kotler, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. I had this feeling that I understood every word that he said. I wasn't sure whether others did, but I did. Because the idea of this shiur started germinating 35 years ago. I'm going to say what Rav Shneur said in Yiddish as he quoted his father. Die Yeshua von Ador kommt nur durch der, was hat nicht öwe gewen, der Chet Ador, und das gewen Mordechai in Shushan Habira. The salvation of a generation can only come through someone who has not transgressed the sin of that generation. And that was Mordechai in Shushan Habira. And I'll explain to you exactly what he meant. In chapter 3 of the Megillah, it tells us that Haman has been raised to great prominence. He is now the alter ego of Achashverosh. He is the one who represents the king wherever he goes. And everybody is bowing, bending, scraping before Haman, because so has the king commanded. Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai will not bend, not bow. Pasuk later says, Vayar Haman saw ki'ein Mordechai korea u'mishtachaveh lo. Haman saw that Mordechai doesn't bend nor bow before him. By Molei Haman Chema, Haman became full of anger, wrath. And then he cooks up the destruction of the Jewish people. The destruction of the Jewish people, men, women, and children, on one day. Who becomes aware of this? Mordechai. Mordechai goes running to Esther, and he tells Esther, you have to do something about it. If you remain silent now, what will happen to the Jewish people? And who knows how long you're going to be queen? Anyway, from that moment on and further, Esther is the one who takes charge. And Esther tells Mordechai, gather together all of the Jews and pray 3 days, day and night, and fast. I and my girls will do the same thing. And so I'm going to come to the king, though I haven't been invited. And the fact is that anybody who comes to the king who's not invited will be instantly put to death, except for the one to whom the king is going to extend the golden scepter. She comes. And she invites Haman and the king to a party. And they come to a party. Now, we're now in chapter 5 of the Megillah. We now know that Haman is Hitler. Yimach Shemei v'Zichrei. We know that Haman plans the destruction of an entire people. Says the Pasuk, Vayetze Haman Bayom Hahu. Haman came out that day after the party, sameach, happy, v'tov lev, and of good heart. V'chirot Haman et Mordechai, v'shar hamelech, when Haman saw Mordechai in the gate of the king, v'lo kom, v'lo zomimenu. Mordechai doesn't get up, doesn't even move. It's as though nobody has walked by. At this stage in the game, when we know that this is the grand killer of the Jewish people, Mordecai, hide someplace. Bow down. Pikuach nefesh. Do something. Even after all of this, Mordecai, not a move, not a twitch. Nothing. Lo kom v'lo zomimenu v'yimolei homon al Mordecai chemo. Mordecai is one of the Jews who never committed a sin of the generation. Unbending, unyielding, uncompromising. He didn't bow down to the statue of Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't bow down before Haman. The Yeshua von Ador Chabarin said the salvation of a generation can only come through somebody who had not transgressed the sin of the generation. And that was Mordechai in Shushan HaBira. He refused to bow, to bend, to scrape, to yield, to compromise. He remained absolutely firm, steadfast. Nothing was going to make a difference to him. His principles were more important than anything else. He was not interested in making political or other accommodations or compromises. I mean, strong. I have a feeling and we're going to come toward a number of concluding thoughts. Gemara in Masechet Megillah says that there was a debate that raged amongst different families, the family of Yehuda and the family of Binyamin. And the difference of opinion, they want to know from which tribe did Mordechai come? Because the Pasuk says, Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan HaBira, there was a Jew in Shushan HaBira, Ushmo, and his name was Mordechai Ben Yair Ben Shimi Ben Kish Ish Yemini. Ish Yemini means that he is from Binyamin. So the Gemara asks, is he from Yehuda or is he from Binyamin? Different opinions in the Gemara. One opinion in the Gemara says that either his father was from Yehuda and his mother was from Binyamin, or his father was from Binyamin, his mother was from Yehuda. There's another opinion in the Gemara that says that Yehuda took credit for Mordechai because Mordechai came from Shimi ben Gera. Shimi ben Gera is a person who cursed David HaMelech, and David had the right to strike him down, but he didn't, because David let Shimi live. Ultimately Mordechai was born. So therefore the tribe of Yehuda said, because of us you have a Mordechai. Others claimed, no, it's because of us. By the way, there were others who said, no, they blamed Binyamin. They blamed Binyamin for Haman. If Shaul, king of Israel, from the tribe of Binyamin, had not let Agag live, Haman would never have been born. And then there were others who even turned around and said, you know who's the cause of all of this suffering? Mordechai. You think there weren't Jews that blamed the rabbis? What are you talking about? Blame the rabbis. They're always the best ones to blame. What? Rabbis come out with Piskei Halacha, you understand, and for that I will say I am proud of the fact that I was one of the rabbis that issued the Psak Halacha that soldiers should refuse orders to remove Jews from their homes. But the whole country stood up and said, rabbis, what do they know? Who gives them the right to Paskin? What are you talking about? Who gives them the right to Paskin? We're the ones that have to make decisions in Jewish law. That was an aside. If I keep going about that, why would I get upset? Would I get upset? Well, you know, I'm a big hero now. I'm not so frightened of being arrested. A year ago, I don't know if I would have said it at the Torahathon. All right. I have my own pshat.
I have my own pshat on Mordechai. Ish Yehudi Hoya Shushan Habira. There was a Jew in Shushan, the capital. Ushmo Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish. His name was Mordechai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimi, the son of Kish. Ish Yemini. There was one Jew who walked the streets of Shushan Habira and remained absolutely loyal to the oath that was taken at the rivers of Babylon. Im Eshkochech Yerushalayim Tishkach Yemini. A generation had forgotten. Two generations had forgotten. There are those who are Nenu Misutosu Shalosi Arasha. Those who bow down to the Tselem. If you wanted to take a look at a picture before your very eyes of a previous generation, a Godel B'Yisrael, you wanted to see somebody who was full of love of Eretz Yisrael, one who had never compromised, who had never made peace with the exile. To him, though he had achieved greatness, for him Babel remained foreign, strange, alien, gullus. As you saw Mordechai walking through the streets of Shushan Habira, you saw before your very eyes a picture of an Al Naharos Bavel Jew. I remember West Hempstead. I was rabbi in West Hempstead for 11 years before I came on Aliyah. Community that I loved and admired. They may even have liked me. I think so. There was an old man, and my father, Olav Shalom, was living with me, and the two of them, it's fascinating. My father always used to refer to the other man, the old man told me. And I said, my father most probably was 85, and the other one was maybe even younger than him, but the two old men. My father used to like the old man. I had a very special thrill every time I saw the old man come to shul, and he sat not far from me. Because in the early years of the century, he had been a ben bayis in the house of Reb Meir Simcha HaKoyim Mitvinsk, the Mesher Chochma, the Or Sameach. I saw this Jew. I felt that I had a connection with one of the giants of this century. I saw him. I saw Reb Meir Simcha. And every so often I talked to him about the house of Reb Meir Simcha. I tell you, I saw him, and I saw Reb Meir Simcha. You saw Mordechai in the streets of Shushan Habira. You saw a Jew who was full of Ahavas Eretz Yisrael. Nothing had changed. He was the Ish Yemini. The Ish Yemini. I want to close with what I believe is said by the Malbim. Malbim says that in that oath of Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim Tishkach Yemini, Jews in fact took three oaths. There are three separate and distinct parts to that oath. Part one. Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim, if I forget you, Yerushalayim, Tishkach Yemini, let my right hand forget its cunning. The hand, the right hand, represents to do, to act on behalf of Yerushalayim. Tidbak leshoni lechiki, part two. Let my tongue stick to its palate, lo es kerechi, if I will not remember you, Yerushalayim. Talking about tongue, palate, lips, speech. Not only did they take an oath that they would act on behalf of Yerushalayim, they took an oath that they would speak out on behalf of Yerushalayim. And the third, the last part, Im lo alet Yerushalayim al rosh simchati, at the moment of my greatest joy, I will remember Yerushalayim in my thoughts. That's why we break a glass
By a chuppah, we sing here in Yerushalayim, we sing Yimeshkachech Yerushalayim Tishkach Yemini. What it really means is that this oath was a three-part oath. There was an oath in thought, in word, and in deed. We are going to stand behind Yerushalayim. If there has ever been a generation, a moment, in which Jews have to take that oath all over again, that's us, right here and right now, because the battle for Yerushalayim is on. That battle is taking place right now before our very eyes. I'm frightened, God forbid, if things don't work out as we want them to work out, what would I say to my grandchildren? And when they will ask me, were you living in Yerushalayim Zayde when they divided the city, Rachman and Itzlan? From 1967 until the walls of Berlin came tumbling down, I remember speaking on a number of occasions at which I said that from 1948 until 1967 there was an ugly equation that existed in the world. Two cities divided in half. Two cities with a wall going through the middle. Berlin and Lahavdil, Yerushalayim. What an ugly, ugly, painful equation. Came the Six-Day War, and the walls of Yerushalayim came tumbling down, and the city was reunited. I said, Rebbeinu Shel Olam, Yashikayach. Let Berlin remain a divided city, and we're going to be a unified city. I am frightened out of my wits that the walls of Berlin have come tumbling down, and I'm afraid that the walls that will separate Yerushalayim are going up. If God forbid that happens in our days, we will have nobody to blame but ourselves. And therefore we're going to have to find the ways and means of making sure that that becomes our consuming struggle. We're the ones who are going to have to fight for Yerushalayim. And we're also going to have to tell it to our friends and our neighbors and our mishpucha in Chutz Laretz that the battle for Yerushalayim is raging. I still don't understand why we don't get 250,000 or 500,000 people to stand on Har Choma to say, we are going to build here. We're going to build any place we want in Yerushalayim. It's our city. I always had this sinking feeling, and I know that even here I sort of expressed it. Over the last number of years, a representative of the government of the State of Israel knew that if his speech wasn't going too well, when he's speaking for, I don't know, Bonds, UGA, Federation, there was always the tearjerker, the heart tugger. All you had to say is, Abba Jerusalem will remain forever, eternally, undivided capital of the State of Israel. And then you can see the crowd begin to cheer. People would start taking out Kleenex and dub tears from their cheeks. I'm afraid that it was all talk. I'm afraid that it was all talk. The action is going to have to come from us. The message of Purim is, Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan Abira, there was a Jew in Shushan Abira, whose name was Mordechai ben Yoir ben Shimi ben Kish Ish Yemini, Asher Hegloim Hagolah, Asher Haglusam Yechon Yom Melech Yehuda, who had gone into exile even earlier than all of the rest in the days of Yechonya, king of Yehuda, Asher Heglan Nebuchadnezzar Melech Babel, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel, had sent him off into exile, and he remained the Ish Yemini throughout, unbending, uncompromising, unyielding, strong, steadfast. The challenge that we face is to be Ish Yemini in Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh itself. I think we're up to it. I think we can do it. Thank you. Can I have your attention for a moment? Where is it? Did I have a bag here? Oh. Speaking of Yerushalayim, not that. Speaking of Yerushalayim, today happens to be the day of issue of a new series of Torah tapes by some fellow called Gold. Show them that picture of Yerushalayim. You show them the picture of Gold. That they don't need. That's Sefer Shmot, and there will be a series of tapes on each one of the five Kumashim. There is also a four tape series called Eretz Yisrael in Halacha and Hashkafa by Rav Shalom Gold. Now, today happens to be the day of, the unofficial day of issue. If you want to order them, you can see my wife. She's someplace. Bela! Oh, there she is. You can order them for pre-release price for 12 tapes, $60. For the four tapes, $15. I think that you should... 20? Did I say 20? 20. Okay, 20. I'll tell you. I would want to get 4 and 12. That's the way we worked it out. If I would be you, I would want to be the first one on my block to have the latest Jerusalem Reflections. Anybody want questions? Bavakasha. Yes? All right, good question. The question was, if Ezra and Nehemiah had already gone to Eretz Yisrael, why didn't Mordechai go? Very good. Number one, because he was needed in Babel. And number two, after the story, I have proof from a number of places that he went on Aliyah. Mordechai, the fact is, Mordechai went on Aliyah. And the idea that he was needed in Babel... They needed one Jew who was going to walk the streets of Shushan HaBira that would remind them of Im Eshkachek Yerushalayim Tishkach Yemini. And let me say the following. At one time I didn't understand, and then I did understand. I didn't understand the position of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Schuso Yogan Aleinu Amen, who was opposed to rabbis and educators going on Aliyah. He told me not to go. And I was upset. And a few years later, I understood him very well. And I do tshuva for the fact that I had questioned his position. Don't get me wrong, I have absolutely no regrets that I came on Aliyah. I had to do what I had to do. But as a general rule, what do we want? Do we want to empty Chutz Laretz of good people who are going to lead Klal Yisrael? They need leadership desperately. I understood the Rebbe. You know, I was the big idealist. When I came here, I thought, even if I have to dig ditches, it's worthwhile being in Eretz Yisrael. You're kidding me. Dig ditches? I would have gone mad, stock raving mad. I didn't know what to do. The only thing I knew how to do was be a rabbi. And they told me, who needs rabbis in Yerushalayim? And then I find out, they may need rabbis in Yerushalayim. But Mordechai was needed, and he knew it. I hold that Mordechai had Ruach HaKodesh and knew that he was needed there, and when the tragedy was averted, he went to Aliyah. Okay.
Yes,
any other questions? Yes.
Yes. The vast majority of Jews refused to come in Aliyah after the 70 years of exile in Babylon.
Yeah.
So my question is, being that the so-called Torah scholars, most of them stayed in Bavel, why do we learn Gemara in Aramaic instead of Hebrew? That's my question.
By the way, I want you to know I like him. He was the first one who ordered my tapes and has been calling me for years. I like people who order the tapes. Yeah. I can't answer your question. I can't answer your question. The Gemara was written in Aramaic. The Gemara says that there's a certain holiness to Aramaic because in a certain sense it became a Jewish kind of language. And what about Yiddish? You know, don't go overboard with this Israeli stuff over here. I'm just driving up the block and my wife tells me, take a look over there. Can you read that sign? So I started reading something, contact. I thought it was contact lenses. Then I see Kentucky Fried Chicken. Come on! 1,000 years Jews learned in Yiddish. There's a holiness to Yiddish. It's of course not Lashon Kodesh. Aramaic was used as a means of transmitting Torah. It became holy. You have more serious problems than that, I'm sure. Okay.
Rabbi Gold.
Yes?
The holiness of Jerusalem is very quite clear. Now, a lot of people will tell you if you're going to defend Har Homa and take 10,000 people there, why don't you take them on top of Mount Olive and build the third temple?
By the way, you're right. I think that one of the tragedies of our generation is that we did not stake a claim on Har Abayit. I don't understand it. It's unbelievable that we didn't stake a claim for Har Abayit. I and it could have been done. I agree with you.
One more, just a second.
One more question, that's it. Okay. Yeah, I'm ready.
Rabbi Gold, asked in your talk, the student said the dinner a year before and... The Rav said it was 45 years before. Aren't you being a little bit late? The fight for Jerusalem, yes, it's now. But it was years ago.
Yeah, right.
We missed the boat.
Nah, we haven't missed no boats. And I've been talking about it for many years. Come on. Don't worry. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. That's us.
Thank you, Rabbi Gold.